and welcome back to the Thomistic Institute podcast. My name is Father Gregory Pine, and I'm an assistant director of the Thomistic Institute. I have to remember that title every time I give it. Clearly, I have interiorized it. Regardless, we're here for another installment of off-campus conversations, and I'm very delighted to be joined by Professor Timothy Paul. Thanks for joining.
Hey, I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Hey, some people might know you from having had the most prodigious beard in all the land, a beard which struck fear into the hearts of men, which offered comfort and consolation to those who knew not that such feats were possible. But may it rest in peace, may it return in due course. But for those who don't know you, would you just say a word of introduction, who you are, where you're from, and what you do?
Sure. I'm Timothy Paul. I'm a professor at the University of St. Thomas. I used to have a beard here, it turns out. I no longer have much of a beard here anymore. let me think. My work is primarily on philosophy of religion. In particular, the best arguments I can find against Christianity, or in particular Catholic doctrines like the Incarnation, and then the best responses I think you can give to those arguments. That's the sort of thing I typically work on. But now I've been working a bit on virtues, in particular how Aquinas understands virtues and how that might fit or corroborate with contemporary psychological data on virtue.
Okay. Have you taken any inspiration from like Homeric vaunting in your entertaining of arguments against the Christian faith and, you know, rebuttal thereof? Kind of like read up on Iliad Book 7, the way that Achilles, I guess he wouldn't have been fighting at that time, but the way that Patroclus might vaunt over his enemies across lines and like use that as a kind of inspiration for your engagement?
That's a great idea. I haven't yet. I've really practiced my smug chortles and my backpatting, my auto backpatting.
Oh yeah.
But no, I haven't tried it like that. That's a good one.
Yeah, if you can incorporate never again will you look on the rosy fingered dawn into one of these exchanges, that might produce zero results or negative results, which may reveal more about me than it other will. So yeah, okay. So let's talk then a little bit about virtue, so that I am not tempted to such like vaunting. I'm teaching a class right now on the cardinal virtues. I studied dogma, so it's sweet because I get to learn the material 5 seconds before I teach it to my students. But you have learned the material in advance of your students by more than 5 seconds. But have you taught virtues courses at St. Thomas, whether on the college side or on the seminary side? Those have been things that you've gotten yourself into.
Yeah. I've taught in quite a few courses on virtue at the core undergraduate side, and mostly metaphysics at the seminary side.
Okay, nice. Well, I think Tottenham is one for those Tottenham Hotspur fans out there. It's a kind of shout out to them. But also, I have a bunch of nieces and nephews. You have children, and I've learned a lot of things about rule based logic when it comes to past perfect participles, because it's like the irregular ones, they just don't come along until like late three, early four. Until such time, it's just, you know, bringed and stuff like that. But Totten, it's like a kind of transition past perfect participle. It's like, I know that there are regular ones, but I don't quite remember how they work. So thank you for that illustration. You're very pedagogical.
Hey, thank you.
But yeah. So
I'm getting there. I'm close. I'm like 6-year-old level right now.
Yeah. So a 6-year-old with a beard. So leading us in, we're going to talk a little bit about the cardinal virtues and specifically about the virtue of fortitude. But do you have kind of hermeneutic keys or particular things that have come up in your research recently that you think really breaks open the study to those of us who are interested, or even to those of us who are uninterested?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I really like working on patience, which is what I've been working on the most, patience and perseverance with psychologists. I think working with psychologists generally is just a great thing to do when you're thinking about the virtues, because it's one thing to sit in your armchair and figure out, what would courage be? And you do all the work of thinking it through. But there's another question of like, does this apply at all to the real world with humans in it? And I think the psychologists are great for burning that sort of test, you know, and corroborating. I think if there's anything I want to say today, it's that the ancient Christian moral wisdom that you find in the deserts and you find in people like Aquinas, later thinkers like Scopoli or Thomas a Kempis, the Christian moral wisdom you find there is corroborated in large part by the findings of contemporary psychology. It's like they look into how one grows in virtue, how one eradicates vice, and you see stark similarities between what the contemporary findings say and what our old heroes said.
Yeah. So this type of approach, I've encountered it in a couple of corners, just seen a little bit of the work of like Giuseppe Butera on like comparing kind of CBT approach and then kind of virtue ethics approach or kind of interdisciplinary approaches to these types of questions. And then having just worked a little bit with the folks at Divine Mercy University, or having taken a class co-taught by, a moralist and a clinician at Divine Mercy University. And that's certainly been super fruitful. But I think like maybe a lot of people who are inclined in one direction or the other don't even really know how to host the conversation, because it's like, I'm just overwhelmed trying to master my own methodological approach. Like, how could I possibly become a good practitioner of another methodological approach without just, kind of stumbling into things or proving myself a bumpkin? So maybe when it comes to the approach itself, do you have just kind of particular habits or particular virtues that you would commend to the student of these realities?
Yeah. One thing I found super helpful was finding a mentor in psychology. So all my training's in philosophy and some in theology as well. And I knew next to nothing at all about psychology. And I didn't want to become a good practitioner of psychology, like I'm going to run my own experiments. I knew that was just totally hopeless. I would not do it nearly as well as they would. But I wanted to at least be able to read and understand their findings, be a good, educated interpreter of what they say in their articles and understander of it. And so I think finding a mentor is a great thing to do to figure it out. I think working with someone in psychology at your university or taking an intro class in psychology just to get the key terms and concepts is a good way to begin the enterprise.
It seems like in their own way, each discipline, I mean, philosophy and psychology has a kind of claim to master science, if not theoretically speaking, kind of practically speaking, in that, philosophers, have a pretty keen appreciation for what is, and they're kind of chastened or disciplined by, like what is. And as a result of which, they try to be very careful about the way in which they approach so as not to kind of fly off the handle or kind of pronounce from a distance or from on high in a way that doesn't actually mm-hmm. cohere with reality. They leave that to the theologians. I'm over here being a theologian, just admitting it, something of a demagogue myself. But then the psychologist, I think, insofar as it has like a pretty, powerful explanatory force, the psychological science will often, posture, or they'll often kind of position themselves in this way so as to give an explanation, not necessarily of everything, but of everything important under this formality or that formality. So how is it that you get, like, how do you subordinate one to the other, or how is it that you get them to talk to each other in just such a way as to respect those methodological bounds and to like draw insights from both in a way that just isn't just like cherry picking, but it's actually, integrated?
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I worked with Sarah Schnickner, Dr. Schnickner at the University of Baylor, and she has a lab called the Science of Virtues Lab, where she and her students will do experiments on virtues, or at least attempting to experiment on whether, say, patience is correlated with achieving one's goals more than, say, the lack of patience is, something like that. And what I found to be useful in these sort of discussions is philosophers are quite good at giving conceptualizations, carving our concepts at their joints, giving understanding of what the term might mean. Where we don't get as much practice is what they call operationalizing those terms. So figuring out a way to get it into concrete reality and test it. So I can tell you all sorts of distinctions underneath endurance or fortitude, but then telling you how to test for that and only that, pull out the other things which are relevant but not it, is tricky. And I think the psychologists are trained in that sort of thing quite well. And so in my own work with the psychologists, I found, this is an oversimplification, but it might be something like the philosophers bring the conceptual apparatus and distinction drawing, and the psychologists bring the operationalization, that's a hard word for a philosopher. They bring that, and together, I think we do a good job of both figuring out the concepts and finding ways to test them.
Yeah. It strikes me that that would be, you know, just thinking about classroom experience, I'm fine describing things as I understand them to other human beings, but I often find it difficult to host conversation in a way that's fruitful, because it's like, it's not hosting conversation to say like, can you discover the things which I myself have already discovered? And we're going to do this by me like winking and nodding and hoping for the best. Like it's a real art to elicit conversation or to promote conversation in a way that helps those engaged in it to come to knowledge of the truth. And I imagine something similar can be said with designing these types of experiments, because it's like, there's just so much matter and contingency and whatever else is mixed in involved with these types of things. So how are you going to isolate for the pertinent factors? And then how are you going to prove that you have in fact isolated for the pertinent factors? And then how are you going to interpret the data? And then how are you going to apply the data? Have there been some things that you found in the process of working with psychologists that have given you an appreciation for like how these types of distinctions can be drawn and how these types of findings might be one, gathered, and two, you know, leveraged?
Yeah. Yeah. Two things I could think of off the top of my head. One is this: the contemporary psychological work has to draw important distinctions that we know of already from philosophy. So for instance, motivation matters when you're doing something from a virtue. If you and I both give to charity, but I do it to look good and you do it out of the love for the poor, only one of us has a shot at acting according to virtue in that situation, and it's you in that situation. So one thing the psychologists have to do is find some way of getting rid of all the acts in their action set that are done for improper motives or reasons. And that's quite tricky to do, it turns out, because most often you get those sort of things from first personal reports. You know, why did you give that money to charity? And typically the guy isn't going to say, well, I got this crush on this girl and she was there and I wanted to look good in front of her, so I did it. So there's a first personal bias that you have to try to get around in these sorts of studies. Otherwise, you're just not studying the right thing. You're studying the giving to charity, which is a good, noble thing to do in a lot of cases, but you're not studying the virtue of charity in the heart, which is the thing you're trying to study if you're trying to study virtue. So that's one thing is the work the psychologist has to do is influenced by what the philosophers have to say about the motivational structure required for virtues. And the second thing is this: the Christian moral wisdom has a lot of testable hypotheses in it. So, for instance, consider what the church fathers say about the importance of fasting. Aquinas will cite Augustine and Jerome, giving a whole suite of things that allegedly follow from fasting. The curbing of lust, for instance, follows from fasting, from food. And you might think, well, those are all testable hypotheses. Is it really the case that when one fasts, one is less inclined to act in a lustful manner? And these are testable, and so psychologists can actually go and try to figure it out. We've got a whole laundry list of ways that the church has told us, or members of the church have told us, how to cultivate virtue, and it's an open question whether they actually work. So one thing the psychologists can do in discussion with people like me who work on the philosophical philosophy of it is to see whether or not the things the church or members of the church have said to do, in fact, work toward growth in virtue.
Yeah, it strikes me like that first person bias piece, which you described in point one of two, can be navigated in certain ways, but is difficult to navigate in certain ways. I remember somebody describing to me the way in which pollsters try to get around this. It's like not so much a matter of who you will vote for, but asking like who your neighbor will vote for. Because sometimes if there's a shame factor or like a kind of secrecy factor, you know, like in the United States, voting is a relatively secret affair, even though it's become less secret, I suppose, over the course of the last 50 years. But like for my parents to ask one of their contemporaries for whom, you know, he or she voted would have been a kind of ugly thing almost, you know? So like, in order to get around that, you'd ask not so much who you would vote for, but who your neighbor would vote for as a way by which to kind of gather data at the macro level that might indicate who's going to be elected. But, you know, perceptions being what they are, the internet being what it is, even that has begun to drift. So like, what are some of the ways in which, you know, trying to make this distinction between a material act of almsgiving, for instance, and a formal act of almsgiving, whether uninformed by genuine charity or regard for the other and benevolence, or informed by genuine charity and regard for the other and benevolence. How do you sort that in such a way as to, yeah, kind of like drill down at what's actually at stake?
Yeah. part of what's done is asking close peers of the person in question as well. So it's first personal report, but also report of another upon you. And that sort of thing is beneficial. You know, your friend might say, he did it for the girl, and, you know, and it's such, I mean, maybe not for you, of course, but someone else's friend might say he did it for the girl, in which case you've got some good, feasible, but good evidence that the motivation might not have been as pure as the individual himself says it was.
Yeah, it is. It's fascinating that like virtue has this communal setting, not only in that, and thinking here of some of the arguments of like Aristotle and St. Thomas, the reason for which these social virtues remain in force. You know, I was just reading something about the Nicomachean Ethics and whether the Nicomachean Ethics ultimately argues for an inclusivist or an exclusivist notion of virtue. Like, inclusivist is a contemplation with all these social virtues, which have been described at this point as kind of integral parts, as it were, in human flourishing. Or is it just contemplation and you use those things as a kind of ladder that you then kick out? And then, you know, you just kind of abide in the ether to which you have attained. But when like thinking of, it seems that St. Thomas is an inclusivist, even while acknowledging the secondary importance of the moral virtues by comparison to the theological virtues and especially charity. And like when talking about the human community, there's this idea that this is just where we as human beings belong. It's kind of an arch datum, and that virtues are activated, right, or actualized within this setting, but not in that I'm like just using you as an occasion or as an object of the exercise of virtue. But there are certain things in my life that just don't come to the surface, or that just aren't brought to bear until such time as they are realized in the social or political setting. And so it's fascinating that like that even pertains to knowledge, that even pertains to understanding. There are certain parts of my life that I don't really understand until such time as they are mediated to me by those with whom I live. And we can talk about that anecdotally, but it is fascinating that that is even present experimentally, like in the psychological sciences, that others know us better than we know ourselves to a certain extent, or might report more faithfully than we report ourselves. I don't know, but you have a thought or two on that kind of social setting of the life of virtue.
Yeah, I think we're so good at deceiving ourselves about what we suck at, or what we're, you know, what we're not very good at. And I once asked my wife, I said, beloved wife, I would like you to tell me the three things that you think I ought most to work on in myself. And before you worry of anything like this, I'm going to tell you right now, I will not respond in kind. So I'm not just setting you up for three dunks in a row. And here's another thing you need to do. Just you tell me. If you want to find out later, you can ask me some other day. But today, just about me, what are the three things you think I ought to work on? And I had my own list of three. None of you will ever find out either list of three. But I had my own list, and she gave me her list, you know, in a very sweet, tender way, with all the caveats one needs to still feel loved at the end of hearing such a thing. She's very good at that. And the important point for this story is our lists didn't overlap. The things I thought I needed to work on, I was like, are you sure those? Okay. And, you know, she lives with me. It's, you know, she knows me quite well. And so it was surprising to me how much time I put into trying to figure myself out and how much I hadn't gotten very far in discerning what I needed to work on. So our hearts, I think, are just opaque to us. You know, they're black books, and you might think you've got certain features or qualities and need to work on others and just be wrong about it.
Yeah. And also, too, like there are certain things about which you care and certain things about which she cares. Obviously, there's going to be some serious overlap. But like what we care about also conditions what we attend to, because it's like, Listen, I'm going to drive from point A to point B. And for me, what I genuinely care about is getting to point B in a somewhat efficient manner and leaving enough bandwidth to like do language listening exercises. So that way I can feel good about myself as having utilized the time well. But like, for my passenger, if there is a passenger, heaven forfend, that person cares probably more about, you know, his or her bodily integrity than I do about mine, even while I'm being somewhat flippant. But like there are different things at stake. There are different cares being expressed. And as a result of which, we're going to attend to different parts. So like I'm thinking, you know, like this thing took 40 minutes and I listened to 40 minutes worth of Spanish and French exercises and I'm feeling great about my life. Whereas the other person's like, you took a year off my life.
Yeah.
So it's like, maybe you should think about being a better driver. Over here, I'm thinking like, maybe I should upload another podcast to this language learning tool that I have on my phone. So that way I can get better flashcards. So yeah, it's also like a communal reflection on what matters. And that also helps us to come to a deeper appreciation of, you know, in what the good consists and how that ultimately is to be reflected in my life, which is a work in progress. Even for those of us who are not married, this is brought to bear. Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah.
I learned 20 years ago now, the importance of not talking philosophy or theology with a Dominican, or I guess it's fair to say then he was a proto-Dominican, wasn't Dominican yet, with my roommate, who is now Father James Brent, who was my roommate in graduate school. And I learned shortly after moving in with him that you don't talk about anything having to do with philosophy or theology while now Father James is driving, because his mind immediately goes to the stratosphere. And he's thinking about potency and act and divine simplicity. And you're just saying all the rosaries at once, you know, you're like, but Jim, pay attention. So yeah, when you're in a car with a Dominican, a second thing I want you all to learn from this podcast, in a car with a Dominican, you talk about broccoli. You talk about maybe sportball, if that's an important thing that he doesn't care much about. But you don't talk about potency and act, divine simplicity, the Trinity, yeah. Any of that.
No, that's our warranted Christian belief. Heaven forbid. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you've done some research recently on the virtue of fortitude. So we've talked about the methodology. We've talked about some of the fruitful collaboration which has gone into these studies. But set us up to think about fortitude. Maybe what's a definition or what's a good approach for understanding fortitude and for practicing fortitude?
Yeah. Well, goodness. How high should we start up? Should we go out in the stratosphere and work our way?
I mean, we're not driving, so I don't see any reason why we should. Yeah, it's for you to determine and for me to facilitate.
All right. Good. Well, what if we start like this? What if we start by thinking of just the appetites that humans have? So among the appetites humans have, we've got what you might call your rational appetite, your will. And that's the desire you have for things irrespective maybe of the appetites or urges that you have, the more base urges that we share with animals. The medicine might taste terrible. It might furthermore give you really bad stomach cramps, but you might still will or desire to take it for the sake of the good you foresee intellectually in taking the medicine. So you've got your rational appetite. Among your non-rational appetites, we can distinguish two of them. There's one called the concupiscible appetite, which you might just think of as your desire for pleasure, simply so called, or against displeasurable things, simply so called. Like you want the chocolate cake, you don't want the boiled asparagus. That's what you might think of as your concupiscible appetite. And finally, you've got what Aquinas calls the irascible appetite, following Aristotle. So they use different languages, but that's the English of it, irascible. And there the idea is you've got this appetite to avoid the dangerous or difficult or onerous. You're walking down the street with a small child and a snarling dog runs up to you. And your immediate thought is, I got to get away from this dog. That's an instance of the irascible appetite going off, desiring to avoid the difficult, dangerous, or onerous. Now, each of these is going to have a virtue associated with it, a generalized virtue. Excellence with respect to rational appetite, to willing, you might call that justice. Excellence with respect to desiring the good or pleasurable, you might call that temperance. And now finally we come to fortitude. Excellence with respect to standing up to the dangerous or difficult or onerous, you might think of that generally speaking as fortitude. And then I'll stop here, but under fortitude, of course, there's a zillion different distinctions, just like under temperance, there's a zillion different distinctions for each type of thing you might be temperate toward. Like intoxicants, you might be sober, and sex, you might be chaste.
Right. Yeah. No, I was just reading. So I'm teaching a course right now on the cardinal virtues, and I'm teaching a course right now on the passions. And for the passions course, we were reading in, you know, the prima pars questions like 78, 79, 80, 81, 82, which concern, you know, the sense powers, sense cognition, and sense appetition. So we've just been getting down and dirty with the cogitated power as of late, which, as it turns out, is one of the more interesting features of our humanity. But when, you know, St. Thomas, in giving his reverential exposition of Aristotle, he kind of breaks out these things and he situates the virtues as you have done. And I was struck by the fact that he says, with respect to the concupiscible power, you got temperance. It basically covers the phenomenon. And then when St. Thomas gets into the treatise on temperance, then he'll identify those virtues, which you just described, like sobriety and chastity and abstinence and fasting and other things besides. And then when it comes to the irascible power, he says, there's just a lot more going on here. So we're going to need different virtues so as to cover the phenomenon. And I'll identify magnanimity specifically with respect to hope and despair, and then fortitude specifically with respect to fear and daring. And then, you know, like clemency, as it were, and meekness with respect to anger. And I was struck by that, well, for a variety of reasons. But when thinking about fortitude, that it's especially when it comes to things terrible, right? Most terrible of which is death, says Aristotle. Although it turns out that St. Thomas's appropriation of that line from the Nicomachean Ethics was one of the propositions which was condemned by Etienne Tompier in 1277. He's like,
oh, no.
No, it's not. It's actually damnation. How dare you err in such egregious fashion? But you made reference to the fact that we can get even further detailed when it comes to fortitude. So maybe I know that your research has led you in that direction. Maybe we can do some of that, because I think a lot of people find those distinctions super, super fruitful for their own contemplation and super, super helpful for their own life. So could you take us there?
Yeah, for sure. And I totally agree with you. It's super helpful. One important thing is having a moral diagnostic. You know, if you don't even have the concepts, you're not going to be able to exhort people to behave in certain ways. Like, I have children. I want them to grow into people who have the excellences of virtues. But if I don't even have the concepts required to say, you know, I want you to be excellent with respect to alcohol in these ways and avoid these situations. We used to have a word for it. It was chastity. And that was sort of sobriety. And it would encompass all those good things. But now the word sober has sort of smushed over to being a teetotaler. And we don't have a new concept that has fallen into place where sobriety used to be. So we're illiterate, so to speak. We're morally illiterate insofar as we don't have a concept for this. And so I think you're right to point out that having these concepts is super important for us, for no other reason than for being a moral diagnostic we can use for helping ourselves grow and helping those under our care grow. Now, with respect to fortitude, I think it's important to draw some distinctions like Aquinas does. Now, there's different ways of having fortitude. Like you mentioned, there's acting against something. So acting, doing something positively. So there's the active rendition of fortitude. But there's also enduring. You know, lots of fortitude is just enduring well or enduring excellently a difficult or dangerous thing that's happening. And when Aquinas talks about that sort of enduring, he draws a distinction between two different sort of subspecies of enduring. You can endure the actual act itself, or things surrounding the act itself, or you can endure your own internal states with respect to the situation you're in. And we've all had that sort of situation where you're doing something that's objectively difficult or dangerous, but you've got a keen mind the whole time. It's not clouded by the passions. You're focusing, you're directly there. It's a hard thing to do because the situation is hard, but your passions aren't also getting in the way. And on the reverse side, we've all had that situation where you say afterwards, that was not that big of a deal. I don't know why I got so bent out of shape about it. I'm sorry about that. Objectively speaking, the thing I was doing wasn't big, but it felt really big. My emotions got big for it, and I got sorrowful or got angry. All right, the problem was in here, not out there. So you can divide first, when you're enduring, between enduring the act or the event, the external thing, or enduring your internal state with respect to the external thing. Good so far?
Great.
Super.
All right. I want to follow up specifically. I think that, you know, people are temperamentally inclined in different ways. But I think that many people experience some modicum of sadness and loneliness and anxiety in their life. And many of these people aren't offered much in the way of like resources from the Christian tradition that they can identify as like corresponding to their state, because more often than not, they're told things like, just, you know, follow this simple 5-step process and pay easy installments of $19.99 and then it'll go away. But it's like, it doesn't actually correspond to the depth of the sorrow, the loneliness and the anxiety. And as a result of which, it doesn't supply a kind of meaning or purpose which can actually elicit life in the midst of those dark times. Whereas like when I read St. Thomas on the, you know, on the virtue of fortitude, it's like, wow, this is exactly what I want. Because in all of our sadness and loneliness and anxiety, there is a kind of unto death type character, like the way in which certain temptations or the way in which certain vices speak to us. It's like, without this thing, you will die, or in this situation, you will die. Perhaps not physically, but kind of spiritually, as it were. There's a kind of, intensity, as it were, to the clamorous voices in our heads, which would otherwise cow us with fear. But to hear him speak, especially about this endurance dimension, and these kind of features of patience and perseverance, I think is just hugely important, especially for Christian men who might not feel like they have a battlefield on which to wage war against world, flesh, and the devil, but to know that they can conduct something of a spiritual warfare on this very kind of intimate kind of ground or territory is super, yeah, again, super fruitful. So I don't know, could you speak a little bit about this endurance dimension and what goes into it?
Yeah. Yeah. Before I get to that, I think you're totally right. There is a battlefield to be had here. And if we rank importance of things by what the Lord has come to die for, we'll realize that the battlefield of the soul is more important than any other battlefield that there is. You know, you fight for your country. Yes, the country is a good thing. It's noble to love your country. But the Lord didn't come and die for a country. He came and died for your and my particular souls and for our salvation. And so working for that is working, I think, on the most noble battlefield that we can work on. Okay, but how does that fit with endurance? I think of it like this. I had drawn a distinction, like you pointed out, between enduring the external things or the internal things. And for Aquinas, he bifurcates each of those. So the end of my distinctions, for now at least, Aquinas loves his distinctions. But for now, it'll come to these final four in the bottom. And I think of it like this. If you're enduring the external thing, you could be enduring something intrinsic to it or something extrinsic to it. Here's an example. If you're enduring, say, the difficulties of training for a marathon, so you're getting up, you're running, just enduring the miles and miles that you're going, that's something intrinsic to the act of running a marathon. It's something built in to the very act itself. And so Aquinas thinks when you're enduring something intrinsic to the act itself, he calls it persevering. You're persevering through. On the other hand, you might be enduring something extrinsic. So think of cases where you wake up to run and train and it's sleeting outside. That's something extrinsic to the very act you're doing. It's sleeting isn't essential to training for a marathon. Or say you're a child going to school. I think of cases of segregation when it was recently desegregated. And think of those children who courageously went to school at white schools who were black and all the bile they received from people who were yelling at them at the school doors. No, that's something extrinsic to the good of education. And to go through that well is to have a different virtue. Aquinas calls it constancy, the virtue of dealing with the external things that are extraneous to the action you're doing. So that's one distinction. Under the act itself, you can be perseverant when you're persevering with the internal things, or you can have constancy. You can be constant when you're enduring the extrinsic things, which aren't essential to the very thing in question. And the final ones are just, you can be patient when you have your emotional state at the present that you're enduring well. Like, I'm so tired of trying to put on these children's shoes in the Minnesota tundra when they keep kicking them off, when I'm just trying to get them ready to go to school. That's something in the now that's, objectively speaking, not a big deal, but it can make you explode. It can make you super upset. So it's an internal passionate state that's getting out of whack in me. That's patience because it's now. But it might be future directed. Say I sprain my ankle and I'm worried if I can continue training for the marathon. I've never run a marathon and I never will. But I continue training for the marathon. And that's in that sort of situation, that's called what he calls long suffering. It's an internal state at a future directed situation. So it's patience when it's present directed. The kids are kicking their shoes off now. Sorrow at that requires patience. Sorrow at a future state requires what he calls long suffering. And with that, I've got my fourfold sub-distinction of types of endurance for Aquinas.
Okay. So with that set before us, when we think about the principal difficulties of life, you know, different people might identify it in different way depending upon their social and political and cultural setting, or depending upon the time of the day and whether or not they've eaten breakfast. I suppose it's very variable. But it seems like St. Thomas identifies this this feature. So on the one hand, the kind of sorrow, right? And then on the other hand, the kind of duration, to take the distinction that you drew in reverse order. It seems like, you know, like life is hard and life lasts, or life continues. 70 years or 80 for those who are strong, and most of them are emptiness and pain. And I think that, like, both of those experiences often register for a human being as like vacuous. Perhaps the most terrifying thing about them is that they are, you know, empty, or that they threaten to be empty. So I don't know if you have thought, this is kind of more impressionistic, but are there ways in which fortitude like fills our experience, inhabits our experience, you know, like gives us insight into the meaning and purpose, which is attendant upon our experience? I don't know if you found things that lie in that direction.
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I think of fortitude as something like an antidote, not as that which fills us with meaning, but as that which, when we're not filled with meaning, helps us to fight well against the encroaching darkness that is just being alive. So that's how I think of it, more as a corrective and less like a what's providing you with the meaning. Maybe something like zeal would be a thing which does the positive work of providing you with meaning. So maybe the corrective of sloth is what we'd need for that. And then the fortitude would be fighting off the everyday trials of just being a human who's alive.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense. So far as, you know, like we think about fortitude and temperance as engaged directly with the passions, and the passions, you know, kind of supply a certain moral energy, but often enough they prove threatening when they overwhelm an otherwise reasonable or rational pursuit. So a lot of it is just a matter of keeping in check, as it were, curbing or spurring on, or, you know, kind of holding off at arm's length the occlusion of reason, which could arise if we were to kind of capitulate before the whatever it is that our passions are doing at the moment. Thinking then about like kind of quintessential examples of the brave or courageous person, it seems like in the pagan tradition, you have the soldier on the battlefield, and the Christian tradition, you have the martyr before his persecutors. What is it that these types, or what is it that these exemplars reveal to us about fortitude taken to its term, or fortitude in its kind of fullest sense?
Yeah. Well, each virtue, I think, is aimed toward the good. And what the good is depends in part, for you at least, depends in part on your story of what the human person is and what the human person is for. So if you have a Christian story wherein the human person is a body-soul composite created in the image and likeness of God and is for the sake of honoring God in this life and the next, you're going to have a different account of what fortitude ultimately aims at than if you have an account where the human person is just for, say, fame and glory in this life. And so it's going to make sense that based on your theory of what the human person is and what he's for, you're going to have a different account of what the ultimate good is for that person. And that's why I think you see in the Christian tradition, as you point out, it's the martyrs who are our exemplars. It's because it's the martyrs who, above all things, glorify God and choose him above all things, choose to be with him, even in the face of, well, pick your martyr, but, you know, maybe sexual degradation for some of the early primarily female martyrs, or pinching the incense for some other of our martyrs. The goal there wasn't, it's so important not to pinch incense that I'll die rather than pinch incense. The goal was more, it's so important to honor and glorify my Lord that I'll do anything, that I won't do anything that's contrary to that, even in the face of serious danger and death, because I rightly value the glorification of the Lord above those lesser goods, including my own life. That's my hunch.
Yeah. It's interesting how, like the sense of relationship kind of shifts from one paradigm to the other. Yeah, when you think about, in the pagan setting, the common good of the political community is the highest common good known to those who participate it. But in the Christian dispensation, well, like St. Thomas, for instance, refers to God as the common good of the whole universe, obviously a transcendent common good, and according to the logic of common goods, is thereby able to be shared in or participated in by all God's people. You know, so there's like a sense in which, on the one hand, the martyr dies for something more universal. I mean, something more transcendent, which is to say someone more universal and someone more transcendent. But also there's a greater intimacy to it and a greater intensity to it, precisely because God, in being universal and being transcendent, is able to be innermost in each. And that is able to be kind of conducted in the context of a relationship of a different sort than the relationship that we evince with the political community. So it's like, yeah, it's like courage and bravery comes to its fullest expression in the setting of love, you know, in the setting of a relationship. But yeah, I don't know. Final thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful thing you just pointed out. And I think it's an excellence in Christianity that the very highest good for a human is a relational good. And the good that I have in the Lord is a good that will always be internally relational with the Lord. It's deep union, deep loving union. So you don't get just fame or glory as being the ultimate good for the human. You get, I mean, something like that. The beauty of the Christian story is it takes all the insights and from all the places where the insights are found and pulls them together into a single story. So there is, as St. Paul talks about, the weight of glory. You know, there is a glory in heaven. But it's not just that. The problem with the pagans was they didn't have it all there. They had an important element of the story of human goodness, but they didn't have the whole story there. And I think you can say the same for other places, and you find it all coming together or coalescing, at least for Christians, you find it all coming together and coalescing in the Christian story. And so I like that fact that you find interpersonal deep union at the core of what it is to be a human on the Christian story.
Boom. All right. Well, as we come to the end of our time, any kind of parting words or final thoughts or particular gems that you think our listeners would profit from in their meditation upon virtue, the role of psychology in bearing out the findings of the Christian tradition, and then in their own practice?
Yeah. I guess one thing I've been thinking about a lot lately is similar to what I said earlier with respect to sobriety. I've been thinking about virtues that in yesteryear might have been more important and more discussed that currently we don't even have a conceptual apparatus for. So let me give just an example. It used to be the case that the word studiousness meant just general curiosity. It, in more recent times, to be studious primarily, I think, means like book curiosity. You know, the student is studious, but the detective isn't studious. But there was a time when studious meant both. Now, with that word, studious, it's sort of shifted, you know, from a general curiosity to just bookish curiosity. But something else has filled its space. It's, you know, the regular word curious now has a broader notion. It actually used to name a vice related to studiousness, but now we use the word curious to name just broad intellectual curiosity. Not all words work like that, though. So if you think of what I mentioned earlier with sobriety, it used to mean excellence with respect to alcohol, such that the sober person can enjoy the pleasures of alcohol and not go overboard. You don't have to worry about him drinking too much. He might drink more at a wedding than he would at a typical Thursday night. But the point is just he's excellent and calibrated well with respect to alcohol. Now, the word sober has shifted. You know, it's now it means something like teetotaler. I don't drink any alcohol at all is what it is to be sober. And I think unlike the word studious and curiosity, you don't have a replacement word there. I think the closest we have is like on beer commercials in very small font in the corner away from the hot rod or the pool party. It'll say drink responsibly. But of course, that's not what sobriety is. Like drink responsibly. You can do that if you just have an Uber drive you home. You could be smashed and have bedranken. I think that's the word you want me to use. Bedranken responsibly there. And that's not right, you know, so we have, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say there's a vacuum. There's a moral vacuum where we used to have a good concept and term you could use in moral formation of people you love to hold yourself accountable for things. And it's been stricken away. We don't have that term anymore. And there's nothing there. I think the same is true for chastity. It used to mean proper and due excellence with respect to the sexual desire, such that a married couple who has a roaring sex life can rightly be called chaste. Doesn't mean that anymore, you know, and we don't have a term that's replaced it. Or think of meekness. It means excellence with respect to anger, getting angry when you ought to get angry, but not being, you know, baited into anger at things you shouldn't be angry at. Like children do this all the time, right? They bait their sibling to get really angry in a situation such that the sibling gets punished and not them. Meekness was a term we had for that sort of excellence. But nobody knows what that word means anymore. So again, it's another case where we have we had a moral apparatus in place that we could use to help form ourselves and others that we love. And now the apparatus is sort of been mangled and mushed. We become a bit morally illiterate. And there's nothing filling those spots. So what I've been thinking about recently is what all virtues have been sort of shuffled to one side of vice and where there's a vacuum there where the virtue term used to be. And how do we get those terms back? Because they're super important. All of us want our people that we love to be meek and chaste and sober in those terms I just gave of them. How do we get those terms back? That's what I've been thinking of.
Nice. Step one, write books about them. Yeah, we'll see. They're at the heart of the church. We will do precisely those things to which we are called without too much thought as to how this ought to be, you know, like leveraged or applied in the practical order and potentially, you know, sold and distributed. Because I feel like, yeah, we can only, well, perhaps I ought not to end this podcast on a note of like mild despair and bemusement at the way in which the world works. But yeah, I think there's certainly work to be done along the lines that you describe. And I think that you can perceive that actually in contemporary conversations. There's that it's kind of like coming back to center with certain things. And it's fascinating. I think like the pendulum swings in the culture. I was thinking about this with respect to alcohol. Like alcohol consumption amongst my generation, the generation below me it's been plummeting for some years. And I think that there are various reasons for that. I think the mental health crisis has something to do with it. I think that contemporary podcasters or like influencers like Huberman and Goggins have something to do with that. Like the idea of the positive benefits of alcohol is being called into question, but in part that's because there isn't really a culture of like Christian festivity as there once was. Even its twilight, you know, has been occluded by a kind of pagan notion of, you know, seize the day because you can't trust them tomorrow. And that's, yeah, it's just like, it makes it even harder to seize the day because not trusting in tomorrow has extended to not trusting in today itself. So it's fascinating. It's just like, as you see the prevailing culture, the kind of ambient culture lose its mind in one direction or another, then, you know, Christians have to continually recall our contemporaries to, you know, who God is, what a human being is, and then how we're meant to flourish. But it's always going to involve, yeah, different emphases or different approaches because we tend to lose our minds in different directions.
yeah, we do. And sometimes you have to speak in one paragraph toward one person, calling them toward back from excess, and the next paragraph calling somebody else back from deficiency. And it's going to sound crazy to both of them because they're going to say, you were just telling me not to do that stuff, and now you're telling him to do it. And you have to say, well, be careful. I wasn't quite saying be excessive. I was saying for him, he's got to work more toward the virtue, which is, you know, toward the excess for him. It's not excessive, but it's from deficiency toward the middle. And so it's a tricky place to be, but I've got hope. I've got hope because, you know, these things are just objectively good no matter where you're standing, no matter what tradition you're from. What the Christians used to call chastity is a good thing. I don't mean chastity in the contemporary purity rings and frowning, frigid old ladies saying, you know, don't enjoy sex. I don't mean that for chastity at all. That's never been seen as the good thing by anybody. But the virtue of chastity, where you're not led by your pants, where you think carefully before you act, where you don't have to worry about the person cheating on you because they're irresponsible. I mean, that's all good. And that's all what people really want. We don't have the word chastity for it anymore. And it'd be nice if we had something there to present to people to say, this thing that is near and dear to your heart that you really want, we have a term for it, and we have a deep history of thinking about it, both in the Christian tradition, but not only in the Christian tradition. It's not like the Christians were the only people who cared very much about fidelity with respect to the sexual act.
Yeah. No, it's helpful thoughts. I'm like brainstorming over here as to how I want to couple my thoughts together so as to describe this in a conversation later today. But yeah, to call people back to the fullness of humanity, not just the fullness of humanity, but the fullness of divinity insofar as it can be participated by a human being, which thereby heals and grows our humanity to its term. Yeah, wild times. To be a Christian preacher or teacher, man, it's to have the whole of it and then to like not know how to do any of it. What a gift. Uh-huh. Yeah. Great. Well, thanks so much for taking the time. For those who would like to follow up with your work on these particular things, is there a way that they can access that? Do you have a CV somewhere? Do you have a faculty page at your university's website?
I do. I do have a faculty page at my university's website. And I've got an antiquated website of my own, a personal nice. Website that's from like 2021, I think. I think you can see a beard if you want to look. You'll see a luxurious beard on it. I think it's just timpaul@wordpress.com or something like that. But if you just Google my name, I'm sure it'll pop up. Yeah, thanks for asking.
Hey, luxurious and luxuriant. And yeah, we could say more about the virtue tradition, which it has to say about that. But we're going to set it aside, and I'm just going to say thank you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. All right. Turning to you, the listener and or viewer, thanks so much for tuning into this episode. of off-campus conversations. I have to remember what this thing is called each time. If you haven't yet, do subscribe on YouTube or on your podcast app, and you'll get sweet updates when other things happen, things of a noteworthy sort. And yeah, we'll look forward to chatting with you at the next opportunity. So know of our prayers for you. Please pray for us, and we'll look forward to the next time on the Thomistic Institute podcast. Cheers.